Stand by. Welcome to today's program titled The Board and the Pendulum. Four reversals of Obama board precedent begin the rebalancing of the NLRA. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call, Jeff Bosley, Henry Farber, and Peter Finch. Mr. Bosley, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon to all on the call, and thank you for attending. We are going to talk today about a very, very busy week that the NLRB had during the week of December 15th. And as you can see, we're calling this, at least at the outset, 24, the NLRB edition, because when we thought about the week, I don't know if you could hear the clock ticking, but I think that Chairman Miscamara, as his term was ending the week of December 15th, heard the clock ticking, which is one of the themes that we're going to talk about today. We've got two basic themes. One is that the pendulum is swinging with these recent decisions by a full board back towards greater protection for employer rights, or at least greater consideration of employer rights in NLRB decisions. And as we'll go through here on this first slide quickly, after dozens of dissents by then-Member Johnson and Member Miscamara over a long period of time during the Obama administration, there was a very short window to start shifting that pendulum back in terms of revisiting some of the really controversial decisions of the Obama board. The board reached full strength on September 27th, 2017, so roughly 3 months before Chairman Miscamara's term ended. And then it got a new general counsel in November of 2017, and on December 12th announced a request for information concerning the quickie election rules, which are the expedited rules that were effective in 2014 that have been the subject of much debate and discussion. And the board is requesting comments by early February as to whether those rules should be revised, rescinded, or otherwise changed. And then during the week of December 15th, the NLRB, in really five very substantial decisions, reversed five controversial decisions from the Obama board. One of these decisions that we're going to talk about today impacts only unionized employers, but the majority, the remainder, impact all employers, whether the employer has a union or not. Representing its employees. So these are very significant decisions. How we're going to cover these, how we're going to approach these today is again continuing our theme as the clock was ticking down towards zero. Really over the period of 48 hours, the board released four really substantial decisions that made significant changes. The first decision, which I'm going to talk about, revisited the standard for review concerning facially neutral handbook rules, and it created a more refined balancing test for review of employer rules. The second abandoned the so-called micro-unit bargaining unit standard adopted in specialty healthcare, which Henry Farber is going to walk us through. The board then rejected the indirect or reserved control test for determining joint employer status of Browning Ferris, which Peter Finch is going to talk about. And then finally, Henry is going to come back and talk about restored prior precedent concerning changes to terms and conditions of employment while an agreement is open, while the parties are negotiating a successor agreement. The board restored some prior precedent in that area, allowing for changes to be made in certain cases based on established past practice. And Henry will talk about that one with us as well. So that's our agenda for the day, is to cover these four cases. The fifth decision that the board issued is really, I think, kind of an inside baseball kind of decision for board practitioners, which changed the standard for review of settlement agreements in terms of what an ALJ can approve or not. And And for today's presentation, we're going to focus primarily on these four really broad decisions that impact employers, union, and non-union. And again, as Janet said when she kicked us off, if you have questions as we go through these cases, please feel free to send them in through the computer system here, and they will pop up on our screens, and we will endeavor to answer as many as we can. If we can't answer all of them, we'll also try and follow up by email or offline as we go through. So the first case, one that that was seen as a very positive development by employers generally, involved revisiting how the board's going to evaluate workplace rules. For the past several years, employers have faced increased scrutiny concerning workplace rules, often with conflicting results. Those of us on the call have been through many of these rule cases, a lot of which have resolved through settlement and haven't been litigated. The ones that have been litigated have not ended well for employers generally in terms of review of facially neutral rules in the workplace, such as rules involving recording and use of cameras, rules regarding civility and harmonious conduct generally, and other rules in the workplace, which has been heavily litigated and heavily discussed. And for at least the last 13 years or so, these rules have been evaluated under the framework set forth in Lutheran Heritage. And under Lutheran Heritage, the mere maintenance of a facially neutral rule has been found to violate the Act if employees would reasonably construe the rule as prohibiting protected activity. So this prong, which is one of three prongs in the Lutheran Heritage test, has been referred to in shorthand as the reasonably construe standard, which is based on the language of the test, on whether an employee would perceive a rule as chilling or preventing them from engaging in otherwise protected activity. And again, what has happened is, and is detailed by the board in a really substantial, 40-plus page decision, applying this Lutheran Heritage standard has resulted in really conflicting decisions and some overbroad, and some decisions primarily finding rules overbroad or ambiguous, which the criticism of Chairman Ms. Gamara in establishing a new standard is that the old standard really required what he called linguistic perfection, which meant as we were reviewing your handbooks and working through handbooks for clients, we were taking a lot of general rules and trying to make them as specific and detailed and anticipate how they might be applied in the future to narrow them. And one of the criticisms that Chairman Ms. Gamara had about that Lutheran Heritage Standard is it required a degree of precision that really, it put too big a burden on employers in terms of drafting rules that they knew would somehow not run afoul of the Lutheran Heritage Standard. A key example for Chairman Ms. Gamara was a 2016 decision in William Beaumont Hospital, which is a really sad case in a lot of ways in terms of the key issue in the case was whether a rule that stated that nurses and doctors should foster harmonious interactions and relationships did that rule violate the Act? And the decision of the majority at that time, Chairman Ms. Gamara was not chair yet, he was just a member at that time, was that that rule was overbroad and ambiguous, and because some conduct that might necessarily be harmonious could also be protected, that employees would view that rule as violating their rights under the Act, and it might chill protected activity. Well, the sad fact in that case, this is not why the rule was adopted, but an infant died in the case at issue, and while the facts were explored in that case, it was found that some of what had happened is improper communication, or rather ineffective communication between medical personnel, including bullying and other things, that prevented the team from truly working as a team. And, ever since that decision was issued in 2016 through issuance of the Boeing decision, which we're going to talk about next, Member Ms. Gamara and then Chairman Ms. Gamara really focused on that as a good example of how really this generalized statement of wanting people to work harmoniously should have very little, if any, impact on anyone engaging in protected activity, but obviously had a huge impact on providing patient care, and that this standard interfered with the laudable goal of most employers, which is that, as a general rule, they want people to act in a harmonious way, and they want people to be able to work together in a way that's civil and respectful. So this was one of the main drivers and one of the main bases for his new standard in Boeing. In Boeing, the specific facts of the Boeing case, which is the new decision which established a new framework, the employer maintained a no-camera rule prohibiting unauthorized photo or video recording. The rule is called by the board a no-camera rule. It's a little bit of a it's I think a little misleading to say it's a no-camera rule in terms of cameras were allowed and phones that had camera-enabled equipment on them were allowed on premises. However, there was this strict rule that said those phones and those cameras could not be used to record or take photos of the manufacturing processes and other operations in the plant unless an employee had stated a valid business need who wanted to take photos, or a person, didn't have to be an employee, had to have a valid business need to take those photos, and they needed authorization from security to take photos. And the reasons the employer established this rule, and this is I'm summarizing here, and winnow this down to two reasons, just because if I listed all the 14 or 15 reasons in the case, it would be about four slides. But the Boeing's rationale as a defense contractor, obviously dealing with secure information and export control regulations and the like, was they wanted to, you know, the stated reasons for this test were to protect themselves from industrial espionage, to protect them from international espionage, to protect the employees from being the targets of espionage, to prevent potentially terror attacks, to protect the theft of their intellectual property, and even to protect the identity of specific employees. For the sake of preventing someone from learning, you know, seeing a photo and using that to create an alternative badge to gain access to the facility to somehow infiltrate the Boeing production facilities. So there were many, many reasons that were legitimate for Boeing adopting this policy that there could be no photography or video taken without this test being satisfied and the permit being granted by security. Applying the old standard, an ALJ found the rule was overbroad and violated the Act. Reversing the ALJ, the split board held that the framework did not adequately consider the employer's legitimate interests in promulgating a work rule or the complexities of a specific workplace at issue. And the majority found specifically here that the ALJ had not considered Boeing's legitimate interests at all, which when you review the test, in terms of the reasonably construed standard, employer interests and the complexity of a specific workplace are not mentioned at all in the first prong of Lutheran Heritage. So what the board did here is said we need a new test. And in that new test, we're going to specifically reference the employer's legitimate justifications associated with the rule. And as part of applying this test, we're going to expect that future boards are going to weigh those justifications and also think about the specific complexities of the workplace at issue. So the test as stated in the decision, when evaluating a facially neutral policy, rule, or handbook provision that, when reasonably interpreted, would potentially interfere with the exercise of NLRA rights, the board will evaluate, one, the nature and extent of the potential impact on NLRA rights, and this is key that it's an and not an or, and legitimate justifications associated with the rule. And why is it important that that is an and? What the board was very clear about is that both of those issues are going to be considered and addressed if a rule could be reasonably interpreted as infringing on employee rights. For example, the Boeing no-camera rule. What the board found is there are certain situations where, for example, a group protest. Let's say an employee was using their phone to record video or take a photo of a group protest on site that they then wanted to post on Facebook. That may be protected activity. However, what the board found is that that assuming that that is protected, which it likely is, that the business justifications that Boeing had still supported their rule, which is there should be no photography. And the employees can still engage in group protests. The only thing this did was prevented them from actually taking pictures of it and posting them later, or taking pictures for distribution later. So it didn't prevent employees from engaging in any and all protected activity. It just infringed narrowly on some protected activity to protect Boeing's broader interests in terms of, and frankly, the safety interests of the employees on a broader level. So both of those issues are going to be considered. And what the majority relied on in this decision is this is consistent with what happens in other areas where conduct is absolutely protected. Employees have a right to solicit coworkers about a union or union membership. However, there's a long-held restriction that can't happen during working time. So in terms of, you know, working out what the proper balance is between employer interests and protected rights of employees, that's going to be where the major work for this test is over the next few years. And specifically, what the majority wrote is in applying the new standard, we emphasize that the board will conduct this evaluation consistent with the board's duty to strike the proper balance between asserted business justifications and the invasion of employee rights in light of the Act and its policy, focusing on the perspective of employees, which is consistent with Section 8A1 of the Act. So what this really is a swing of the pendulum to try and move the balance back from favoring the employee's perception of potential protected activity and weighing in the complexities of each workplace and weighing in what the employer's legitimate interests are in adopting a work rule. For example, for hospital employers, having a no photography rule that protects patient privacy, for a defense contractor, having the rules laid out in Boeing. So this is how the rule is going to be interpreted. The other more controversial section of this decision is that Chairman Miskimara and the majority set out three categories of rules, which we've marked in green, yellow, and red, and hopefully they are they're readable on your screen, but I'll walk through them just to make sure we cover these a little bit. Category one, rules that the board designates as lawful to maintain either because the rule, when reasonably interpreted, does not prohibit or interfere with the exercise of NLRA rights, or the potential adverse impact on protected rights is outweighed by the justifications associated with the rule. Why that's in green is in category one, those are rules that the board is going to determine going forward are lawful. And specifically in this first bucket of lawful rules, the board found that the no camera rule in Boeing is a category one rule. The harmonious working relationships rule in William Beaumont Hospital is going to be a category one rule. And importantly, other rules requiring employees to abide by basic standards of civility. So that is a very key statement that Chairman Miskimara is making, that generalized comments about civility and working harmoniously and respecting the workplace, from the majority's view, these are going to be Category 1 rules. And we'll talk a little bit more about that before we move on. Category 2 are rules that warrant individualized scrutiny, and there are no examples given yet for that rule, but they need a little more scrutiny to truly balance out the protected right at issue versus the employer justifications. Category 3 is red. It's red for a reason. You can't do it. These are rules, for example, a rule prohibiting employees from discussing wages and terms and conditions of employment with their coworkers. Well, that's a no-no. It's been a no-no. It will remain a no-no. And then one other caveat, even for the Category 1 rules, is this does not deal with situations where rules are discriminatorily applied. A rule may be facially neutral, but if it's adopted to either chill protected activity or in response to protected activity, or it expressly infringes on protected activity, there's still going to be issues with that rule. So for Category 1, we're talking about facially neutral rules specifically. So what's next? A return to civility, at least in terms of handbook rules? Well, I hope so. I think we put maybe in here. I think if I was looking at a Magic 8 Ball, for those who remember those, I think I'd probably put likely so in here instead of maybe. According to the majority spent a lot of time on civility rules and working harmoniously in their decision. Clearly, this board is going to support generalized statements about the importance of civility and the importance of working harmoniously and the importance of, you know, working respectfully and those kinds of things. However, a couple key issues. One, I expect this decision will be appealed. It's not appealed yet, but it may be appealed, so we'll have to see what happens on appeal. And the dissents, which were detailed, former Chairman Pierce and Member McFerrin dissented separately and in great detail to set up a potential appeal. So the issues are framed for appeal, so we'll have to see what happens. Two, civility was not directly at issue in this case. At issue in this case was a no-camera rule. So the board went out of its way, really, to revisit William Beaumont, even though this case on its facts did not involve a civility rule at all. So we'll have to see how future decisions play out in terms of more decisions that give us more guidance as to the specific scope of that type of rule. In 2016, the EEOC Task Force on Sexual Harassment produced a report, and as part of that report, recommended that the NLRB and the EEOC work together to try and alleviate some of the tension between NLRB decisions and EEOC guidance in terms of preventing workplace harassment. Specifically, the case that Banner Health from several years ago, which set some rules in terms of when you could actually ask employees to keep the subject matter of an investigation confidential. And the guidance in that case was charitably ambiguous. So I think we're going to get more guidance from this board as to revisiting those standards as to asking employees to keep the subject matter and certain content from interviews confidential to achieve other objectives. So with that, I will turn it over. The clock is ticking on us to cover all four of these. So I will kick this over to Henry Farber to talk about specialty healthcare and revisiting that standard.
Thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon, everybody. Before you all go start revising your handbooks and putting back in all the rules that you took out a few years ago, stay with us for another few minutes and let us talk to you about these other cases. The first one that I want to talk about today is another case that should be of interest to both unionized and non-union employers, and maybe even more so for non-union employers, as it concerns how a union might organize your employees. You all are probably aware that during the last 8 years, the NLRB made union organizing easier, really in two big ways. The first was the quickie election rules that got us from petition to election in 2 to 3 weeks rather than a month or longer. And the second was the specialty healthcare decision that allowed unions to organize smaller groups of employees than it could before. As Jeff mentioned, the board is already looking at the quickie election rules. It's asked for input and then presumably will act on that input hopefully later this year, when it's restored to its full strength again. But in the meantime, what it did was it reversed the specialty healthcare decision on December 15th, the second to last day of Chairman Miskimura's term. And that was the case that allowed for these smaller units, the micro units. And what the board did in this new case, PCC Structurals, was to go back to the previous standard for what constitutes an appropriate bargaining unit that had been in place probably for decades before. So the issue that the board faced in this case was when the union petitions for an election, and asks for a specific voting group, but the employer believes that there should be a larger group, that more employees should be included in the voting group, how did the NLRB decide that? There are some basic foundational rules that haven't changed. A union has to petition for an appropriate bargaining unit, and it has long been the law, and nothing we talked about today has changed this, that a union doesn't have to ask for the most appropriate unit. It only has to ask for an appropriate unit. So there can be different appropriate units that the union asks for. Under specialty healthcare, and I'm going to go back a slide. Under specialty healthcare, the union's requested unit was really the default that the NLRB followed. If it was a recognizable group at the employer, a specific department, a specific team, and they had shown the interest in organizing, that was going to be an appropriate unit under specialty healthcare. And an employer would not have been allowed to add additional employees to that bargaining unit unless the bargaining unit really couldn't live without them. And it became the employer's burden to show at a hearing that this bargaining unit couldn't exist unless other employees were added. So then in PCC structurals, the NLRB went back to the old standard. And there are some key components to PCC structurals. The first is that there's no burden of proof on either the union or the employer. What the NLRB said is, we're the ones who are supposed to decide what an appropriate unit is. It's not a burden-shifting analysis. And when I was an NLRB agent many years ago, we were always told that these representation hearings were not adversarial hearings. They were information gathering informational hearings. And so the board, in this case, went back to that concept. Second is, the board is going to look at a variety of community of interest standards, whether the employees that the employer wants to add to the voting group have certain interests in common with the employees that are asked for in the petition. Then the board will decide whether the employees that the employer is asking to add are sufficiently distinct. Those are good lawyer words that create a lot of discussion and ambiguity, but essentially it's a balancing test. And we're going to talk about what those standards are in just a second. The last key component of PCC structurals is the board said, we're going to go back and look at what are industry standards. What specialty healthcare did was blow up some of the standards that had been used for years in industries. So department stores had a typical standard of what a bargaining unit was. Grocery stores had typical standards of what the bargaining units would be. Skilled nursing facilities and other non-acute care hospital healthcare facilities had general standards for what bargaining units would be, and specialty healthcare ignored those. And in fact, specialty healthcare was a nursing facility employer. So the board, in going back to the standard community of interest factors, listed what those factors were. And so they're now up on the screen for you. And the first one is, are employees organized into a separate department? For specialty healthcare, that was really the only question. And the rest were ignored. But the rest of these, as you can see, all go to how much alike the employees are. Are they skilled in the same way? Do they have the same kind of training? And how they work together. Are their jobs integrated? Does the workflow pass through these kinds of employees? Are their working conditions the same? And so it is a much broader analysis of whether or not the employees have a community of interest and whether or not they should be together in a bargaining unit. So we've identified for you some practical effects of this case, the PCC structurals case. So we already have actually our first regional director decision using PCC structurals, and it came out on Tuesday. And in that case, a union petitioned for just the deli employees in a grocery store. And the regional director, this occurred in New York, the regional director in New York said, no, under PCC structurals, these deli employees are integrated with the meat employees because they cover for each other from time to time. Their training is similar. And they also have relationships, work relationships with the other employees in the store. So I'm going to find that the deli employees in this grocery store do not constitute a separate appropriate bargaining unit. So the practical effects of PCC structurals are, one of them is that under specialty healthcare, you could end up with several different micro units, each with different terms of employment throughout your organization. And that can create inefficiencies in your organization. It can create barriers to good workflow in your organization if you have each department, some of which are union, some of which are non-union, with different terms and conditions of employment. So this will allow greater efficiencies in your workplace if you get unionized by having all the workers who have community of interest together. The second is the law, the National Labor Relations Act already specifically says that the extent of union organization should not be controlling in determining what an appropriate bargaining unit was. Specialty healthcare kind of trampled on that because it allowed the union to dictate what that unit was, and if they didn't think they were going to win an election on a larger unit, they would ask for the smaller unit, and specialty healthcare allowed that. And so going back to the traditional standards gets away from allowing the union's success in organizing to determine what the appropriate bargaining unit will be. Third is it avoids what we would call domino organizing. So it would, under specialty healthcare, it would have been a union's practice to organize one bargaining unit, a small one, get a contract, and then start talking to the next small unit saying, look what we got for this unit over here, you all should join us. And so there's leverage for the union in trying to do that. This will allow an employer to insist on any organizing that occurs to be on a broader scale. One of the downfalls of specialty healthcare that perhaps the Obama board didn't consider is if an employer was concerned about this kind of domino organizing, if a union organized a small bargaining unit, the employer might have taken a much harder line in negotiations to prevent a contract that would allow a union then to go out and do more domino organizing. The last practical effect we want to mention today is, since the union proposed bargaining unit is not the default, we expect that there will be more hearings to determine what the appropriate bargaining unit will be, and perhaps longer hearings, since the regional directors will be required to consider different factors and more factors than they were before. And to the extent there are more hearings and longer hearings, that will create more time between the filing of the petition and the actual election. And in many cases, time is a good thing. Now, I expect that those of you who work at acute care hospitals are sitting there smugly thinking, well, we don't have to worry about that. We already have our 9 established bargaining units. And that, to a large degree, that's true. You don't have to focus on this. But we're hopeful that this case is a signal that the NLRB will go a step further in dealing with acute care hospitals, because the Obama board also said that we are going to allow unions that already represent employees at acute care hospitals to add on bit by bit to their existing units. And we're hopeful that given this case, the board will reverse that as well and require them to either add on the rest of the appropriate bargaining unit or none at all. So I think I will now turn it over to Peter to talk about the joint employer cases.
Thank you, Henry. And I'm going to be talking about employer issue that was addressed recently in Hybrand and Brandt. This is referred to Brandt here. This issue, this joint employer issue, when it was decided not too long ago, sent ripples of fear and consternation and concern, I think, through almost every industry, union or not. Franchisors had concerns, people who have contracted or subcontracted, folks who use temporary labor, either side, were concerned, were they going to be jointly or severally responsible if something came up, when they had actually set up these relationships to avoid that kind of liability. And in fact, this this wasn't limited to the labor law community or the franchise community. It went as far, and it has gone as far, as Congress looking to take action to overturn Browning-Ferris on their own, to make it law that joint employer status more than what the board had said. So let's talk about what happened here. In Hybrand, a board majority, 3-2, and the dissenters were involved in the original Browning-Ferris decision. But the majority, led by Chairman Miscamara, again, thinking that the clock was ticking, we needed to do something before the board went back to a 2-2. So the idea is to go back to the pre-Browning-Ferris standard, and that was to make sure that the joint employer relationship actually exists, and then whether there's shared responsibility for the collective bargaining relationship, who needs to be at the table, who needs to answer to the union for differences, and so on. But also, if one or the other were accused of engaging in an unfair labor practice, who is responsible for that? So BFI is dead. Long live Hybrand. The majority in Browning-Ferris said that even if two employees have never exercised joint control, if they had the potential to engage in or have joint control over major terms and conditions of employment, and even if it was direct or immediate, meaning there was maybe some chat between the heads of either the user or the supplier employer or the contractor subcontractor, that could be enough. And that suggested that almost any relationship, and I think the worst case scenario was the general reaction to that on the management side, was that almost any relationship where there are two employers and maybe two sets of employees, that there would be a joint employer relationship. So even if they reserved that joint control or it was limited in routine, they could be joint employers. And limited in routine in this context means telling people, maybe the supplied employers, what job needs to be done, where they need to go to perform it, and when to do it. But as long as they weren't telling those joint or the supplied employees how to do the job, that was considered limited and routine. The Hybrand majority in this case, I think this is a very strongly worded and very detailed decision. And at times, the language got particularly pointed. And as you can see from the slide, the board took issue, and sometimes I think almost in a personal way, saying this is a distortion of the common law. It's contrary to the act, ill-advised as a matter of policy, that it prevented the board from maintaining stability in labor management relationships. This reaction led to a very long decision, a number of points that I believe had been in the hopper for some time. I think Chairman Miscamara had been thinking long hard about this issue, and when a majority of GOP-appointed board members came together, that allowed for rather quick decision to be issued. We're looking at 2 months from the time we had a full board to the time this was decided, which is relatively quick in the NLRB realm. So now we're back to the old standard. And there has to be proof now in an alleged joint employer relationship. There has to be proof employers have exercised joint control over these essential terms and conditions. It's hiring decisions, firing decisions, discipline. and the like. It is not merely that they could or that there's a possibility. There has to be actual control. It also has to be direct and immediate. That would be in the moment, not, as I was suggesting, a backroom conversation or an email conversation about what to do about a particular employee or how many employees are in the job. This would be someone acting in a supervisory capacity and responsibly directing those in their employ. And then it also takes away the idea that limited and routine direction, telling somebody where to do it and when and so on, is enough to create a joint employer relationship. So getting back to what works in most situations where you've got a contractor or a subcontractor or supplied temporary contingent employees, that the user employee giving direction as to where something needs done is just that. It's just giving people an idea. He or she is not responsible for bringing those people in, not responsible for determining who is going to be on a particular crew at a given time, but when given the crew, they are able to kind of direct those things in the moment. Not necessarily discipline, fire people on the spot, and that sort of thing. The idea here was to, as Jeff talked about earlier in the handbook case, we had a lot of uncertainty for employees. They didn't know whether their relationship or whether reservation of control or whether their indirect control would be enough to create a joint employer relationship. They had done everything they could to avoid that situation entirely. So the board in Hybrand wanted to make sure that employers subject to the NLRA had a clear standard to work with when determining whether or not they were within the law and whether they had insulated themselves sufficiently. They also wanted, in their view, to bring things back in line with the holdings of numerous federal institutions. In fact, a part of the decision is dedicated to how there's no law contrary or attacking or undermining or calling into question this standard for determining joint employer status. Now, what happened in this case, in some ways, leads to why this came about in the first place. Hybrand and Brandt, there was a workforce that was made up of employees of Brandt and employees of Hybrand. Those employees did some work stoppages to address the terms and conditions, the wages and benefits and those sorts of things. And that was considered, the board agreed, that's protected concerted activity. And taking actions in response to or to employees for engaging in protected concerted activity is unlawful. And in this case, the board was comfortable applying its new standard to the situation because actually the burden later on the NLRB, the general counsel of the NLRB, to prove that there's a joint employer status. And so this case is, well, we've got a new standard, let's apply it here. And I think to the board's credit, they used an example that would have resulted in a joint employer finding on a test. I think had they used an example where they would have found that under the old test there was no joint employer relationship, it may have undermined the credibility of the decision as one that just works to an employer's benefit or to never find a joint employer relationship, but still point out that there are joint employer situations because of actual control over the terms and conditions of employment. And in this case, Brandt and Hybrand employees were both affected by the joint control. And here's why. I put up here KYP, Know Your Personnel. In this case, they have the same corporate secretary, Terry Brandt of Brandt. Involved in the hiring decisions and terminating decisions for all of the employees. There were 5 Brandt employees and 2 Hybrand employees who were terminated. He also self out when he signed letters telling those folks that they were terminated. And he was primarily involved in hiring the managers and making those decisions at both places as the Hybrand general manager's boss, effectively. So under the old test, you're going to get the same result because there were also same benefits and the common policies, and that the impact to both, they were subject to rules and got the same benefits. So under the old policy, they were also considered, or under the old standard, they would have constituted joint employers. Now, this led the minority, the dissenters, to say, well, why did you have to go and do this? It seems premature to get into a situation where you're actually having to address the joint employer standard that we set forth in BFI, because under either way, they would have been joint employers and held liable. Why did you have to go through this? And in fact, nobody argued that we ought to go back to the old pre-BFI days. They also objected to the process, that there wasn't notice, and they hadn't solicited amicus briefs to hear from others who would be directly impacted by the decision, and that it didn't comport with the Administrative Procedures Act because it was not reasoned in its decision-making. I think the majority looked at this case and saw an opportunity to address what had been brewing and some had been stewing about some time and that needed to get addressed sooner than later. So they took this decision seriously, as you can see from the majority opinion, which runs 35 pages, hits on multiple arguments as to why the BFI standard is improper. And it's not possible to cover all of those in this particular discussion, but pointing out that the board took great care to address all the issues they thought, political, economic, and the practical problems here. In fact, this is the first decision that I can remember in a very long time where the board actually put in diagrams and bullet points to support its position and its points. The first problem was that the board and Browning Ferris went too far. They were effectively expanding the definition of employer and employee, and thus confusing what was going on. But also, it was running afoul of common law standards and the express terminology and definitions in the Act. And if that was going to make a change, if there was going to be some redefinition of those terms, it had to come from Congress. They also claim to be dealing with ensuring that everybody who had a say in bargaining or had some say over the terms and conditions of employment were available, so that a union representing certain employees knew it was talking with the real decision makers. This is where I think the board got a little pointed when they said they were looking to simpler times when labor negotiations were unaffected by direct employers' commercial dealings with other entities. That was kind of a poke to say that that you thought things had changed, BFI board, but in fact, that's not the case. Contractors, subcontractors, temporary employees have long been a part of the American economy and how businesses operate and stay unnecessary, and that those all existed in 1935 when the board was when the Act was passed. And at every amendment, that was also the case. And Congress never saw fit to read the term for employer or employee, and it was wrong for the board to do so here. They also felt that in this case, BFI was going for, rather than using the evidence of indirect or any kind of control, direct central control to say that this is another reason why we find their joint employer status. They use that as the first brick in the foundation, and that anything more than that would have been further evidence. So in the Hybrand decision, the board was reversing that and getting the chronology right in their opinion. So that another reason for doing this. And they also wanted to discussed earlier, the uncertainty that there was to be a clear path, a roadmap for employees, joint employers, if that's what they wanted to set up, or contractors to understand better what it was. And that if there was going to be control, they knew what the consequences of that control would be going forward. And then the final concern for the Hybrand board was that this was intended to rebalance negotiating leverage, and that there had to be, the competing interests had to be realigned, and that some might say that puts a thumb on the scale, or that it introduces too many people. They recognized, or they pointed out, that employers in different situations who contracted or subcontracted may have competing interests. And then you've thrown in into the mix not a relationship between the union and the employer, but now a relationship between the employer and the union, and the various configurations of that, which invites labor stability rather than prevents it. And that was found to be going too far in affecting the leverage and the relative strength of either, also putting contractors and employers at odds when they ought not to be. So what's in the offing? I think obviously we're going to see fewer joint employer findings from the board. I think they're going to be looking for that direct control. And they do a good job, I think, at page 6 of the decision in setting forth what direct control, direct and immediate, and how to define limited and routine. So they have given employers and practitioners a good example of what they need to highlight or be aware of when making relationships. And I also think it's a durable case. Certainly, although it hasn't been appealed, it is subject to appeal or could be appealed at any time. And I believe that Congress has moved so far to protect or overturn the BFI decision suggests that if there is trouble with the Hybrand decision, that they would step in to get that ship. And then finally, I think you're going to see a little bit exhalation, that people are going to be a little calmer about setting up these relationships and going forward more confidently in their business. So that's it for joint employer, and I think I'm turning it back over to Henry. You can tell us more and then keep going.
Thank you, Peter. Just a reminder to everybody that there is a spot to ask questions, and this fourth case that I'm going to talk about is probably the shortest, so we hopefully will have a couple of minutes at the end for questions. So please give us your questions if you have any. The case that I am going to talk about now is a Raytheon case, and it was decided, as you might guess, December 15th. And this is a key issue for those employers that already have unions and that have a collective bargaining agreement that will someday expire, as they all do. So here's an example of where this case would come up. Let's assume that you have a collective bargaining agreement that says the bargaining unit employees get the same benefits as the non-union employees, a Me Too clause. And each year during the term of the collective bargaining agreement, you've made some changes to your benefits plans. You've increased the premiums, you've changed the copays, whatever you've done with them. Everybody makes little changes, if not big changes, every year. In the last year of that collective bargaining agreement, you want to make changes to the plans, but you're about to start negotiating with the union. We all know that benefit plans are a mandatory subject of bargaining, and you know that you cannot make changes to a mandatory subject without bargaining, but your contract has given you that right during the term of the agreement. So your negotiations are going to go on, and you're going to be in a position where your negotiations are still going on at the same time as you need to print your open enrollment materials for your benefits. What do you do? Well, under the 2016 case of DuPont that the Obama board issued, you couldn't make those changes. You would have had to maintain the same terms of employment, same terms of benefits as you had in the prior year, unless you got to agreement or impasse with the union about the entire contract negotiations. And so that rationale gives the union a lot of leverage in those negotiations if the employer really wants to or really needs to make changes in the benefit plans. The new case, Raytheon, recognized the concept of a dynamic status quo, and it balances out that leverage. The case looked at what is really a change, and what it found was, if it was the employer's practice to make changes over the course of the collective bargaining agreement, that is the status quo, the employer's ability to make changes, and that making changes in those working conditions is not itself a change in the status quo, as long as they are similar to the changes that the employer made all along. And so if an employer has a past practice of changing benefits or other things, it can continue that practice after the expiration of the contract. And one important point that the Raytheon board said was, that's true even if those prior changes were made pursuant to a term of the collective bargaining agreement, usually the management rights clause, perhaps the benefits clause in a Me Too provision. That still is a past practice that becomes part of the status quo. So if you change benefits in the hypothetical I was just talking about, if you change benefits every year, you can still do that, even though you might be in negotiations. If you change job descriptions from time to time during the term of the contract and job content for employees, you can still do that, even though your contract is expiring or has expired. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have to bargain about that if the union requests. The union can still, it's still a mandatory subject of bargaining, and the union can request to bargain, and you bargain about it. But now you're bargaining from a position where you are allowed to make the change, and they have to bargain you out of it if that's their inclination, as opposed to the other way around. So you would, in the hypothetical, you would implement those changes, but the union still has, and then the union would have the right to bargain about that. The practical effects of Raytheon, I've talked about. Most important, the way this is going to be used the most, we think, is on the benefit side, where employers previously were stuck with their prior benefits. Now you can make those changes. If you have a collective bargaining agreement, look at your management rights clause and see what all those rights are and what you have used. If you haven't made changes during the term of the agreement, that doesn't mean you now will be allowed to make changes. So we have a question here. Question is, our labor agreement says all employees shall be paid weekly. Historically, we have paid every week on Thursday. Does this ruling allow us to change the pay day to Friday without bargaining that change? Unless you have previously made changes to your pay week during the term of the agreement or without bargaining with the union, no, that this case would not allow you to make that change. This deals with a past practice where the employer has in the past made changes. It allows you to continue to make those changes. So at least from what I know of your situation, you would still be required to bargain that. So at this point, I'm going to turn it back to Jeff to close up. And please, if you have any last questions, put them in the spot.
Terrific. Thanks, Henry. So we're going to go from dynamic status quo to more static status quo. The clock did indeed run out on the five-member board on December 16th. So what do we have now? We've got a four-member board. We are waiting for an appointment for the fifth member. There are rumors that that is underway and that someone's being vetted, and we could see a nominee soon to complete the board again and get us back up to five. Marvin Kaplan has been nominated to succeed Phil Miskimara as chairman. And, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting. Marvin Kaplan, in at least two of the decisions that we've talked about, one being PCC Structurals, which Henry just talked about, and the other being Boeing, the case I talked about, was actually advocating a slightly different position than the majority ultimately went with, that was, I think, creative and protected employer rights even to a larger degree than where the majority ended up. So I think he's gonna think critically about what the precedent should be. So more to come, definitely from now Chairman Kaplan and the board. You know, specifically, where is that change gonna fall? There's some areas which we think are kind of, you know, on the radar as priority issues for the board based on some guidance from the new general counsel, Peter Robb. Purple Communications in terms of use of employer email for protected activity, including organizing, is an issue which is going to be submitted to advice and be looked at and given a fresh look. Discipline during bargaining over a first contract, that's a related case to PCC structurals in a certain extent in terms of the concept of dynamic status quo and past practice and those issues. And rules concerning off-duty access to premises, which has been a hot-button issue for healthcare employers. There's been some comments from Peter Robb and others that suggest that those issues could be revisited as well to return to prior standards. So there definitely is more to come on some very important issues for all employers, and we will keep you updated on those through our advisories and alerts and hopefully more webinars like this one. If you have any questions in the interim today as we finish up, please let us know. I'm just looking. We have one question came in on the joint employer issue. I think this is a question which gets at the issue that I think that our discussion today has really been focused on the Act and the National Labor Relations Act. Unfortunately, with complicated issues such as joint employer relationships, different statutes have different rules, and the fact that the board has returned to the prior standard of direct control for purposes of compliance with the Act doesn't mean that certain other obligations, such as obligations under California wage and hour law in terms of the ultimate responsibility of a user of a temporary services provider for making sure the employees of that provider are paid correctly, those kinds of issues, wage and hour issues. This doesn't change those specific standards under other state laws and under federal laws. But under the Act, this is good news. Under the Act, we are back to a standard that I think is clear, as Peter Finch laid out, clear and understandable, and requires there to be some actual control, some direct and immediate control, which is something that an employer has much more discretion and control over than being bound to a gotcha situation where there may be indirect control or a reserved right that comes back to bite them later. Any other questions or comments from the panel? I think we definitely appreciate you tuning in and listening, and we will hang out for a few more minutes. So if any more questions come up, please let us know, and thanks again.
Hey, thank you very much. I'd like to bring attention to our participants that a link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. And this will conclude today's webinar. Thank you for attending.